It's episode 2 of season 2 of the Doctors and Litigation, the L Word podcast. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Gita Pensa, and in the spirit of those catchy top 10 articles, which I only recently learned were called listicles, I have today a listicast for you. We are going to talk about 10 reasons behind the help resistance of doctors. And, you know, if you feel resistance to talking about help resistance, then maybe this one is for you. Putting aside the laugh track, this is probably the first episode where I'm really going to let my coach flag start to fly, so to speak. So I do feel the need to get a little disclaimer-y and explain a couple of things. One, I'm a coaching mutt. As a doctor, I am totally by the book and all evidence-based, and as a coach, I'm a total mutt. I pull from a lot of different disciplines. My coaching and teaching are always evolving, and so coaching purists might sort of raise an eyebrow sometimes, but I've really started to combine the education and practice I've had with coaching as a discipline with lots of lived experience, and I throw in a bunch of philosophy and cognitive neuroscience stuff and things I learned myself in therapy and coaching and, you know, really all the things that I found helpful when I was feeling my way through the dark for all those latter years of litigation. Another disclaimer I have here is that I am not here to treat any psychological disorders. I'm not a therapist. I'm not a psychiatrist. And if you really feel like you are truly suffering, then you do need to get professional help. And finally, I believe that inspiration is, you know, wherever you find it and how you adapt it. And I'm not a PhD in any of the topics that I bring up. So you may find the need to correct or debate me on these if you know more than I do about a given topic. And I totally welcome that. You can find me and my website in the show notes. And there is actually nothing I love more than a spirited discussion about deep human stuff in medicine and psychology and coaching. And I love to learn. So honestly, just bring it on. So I will start by using a quote that I often use with people that I'm working with. And it sort of exemplifies my muttness. It's advice that Bruce Lee, the martial artist and actor, gave. And by the way, if you are not familiar with the life of Bruce Lee, what an amazing but brief life. Read about it. Created a whole new hybrid martial arts philosophy, which served as the basis for modern mixed martial arts and was obviously a movie star. But he once gave a piece of advice that sums up my attitude towards the coaching and education work I do and what I invite people that I work with to adopt. And it's this. Adapt what is useful, reject what is useless, and add what is specifically your own. So adapt what's useful, reject what's useless, add what is specifically your own. When I say reject, I mean like maybe actually think about a thing, try it on, take it for a test drive before you reject it out of hand. But if something that I'm saying is useless to you, like, all right, throw that thing away. But if there's something that you can take out and adapt to your own life or to your own work or to helping people around you, then please do that. Put your own spin on it. All I really want to do is make you think and offer you some things to think about or tools or concepts to try on. And if I can really make you mull over some of the ideas I'm going to put forth today and in future podcasts, it will be mission accomplished for me. Okay, so let's get back to help resistance. Now, most of us have encountered patients who are help resistant. In psychology terms, the help resistant complainer is like the patient who complains as a way to seek help or support or solace, and then will refuse every treatment that you offer them for various reasons, right? So for every solution, there's a problem. And we all have patients or relatives that might fit the description of a help-resistant complainer. So the concept of help resistance is not really new to us, but today we're talking about help resistance in doctors. And maybe that means you, maybe that means other doctors, because what I find is that a lot of doctors now know that a lot of other doctors are not okay and could probably use some help, and it's perfectly fine for them. They should get all the help they need, but I myself do not need that. I am specifically addressing doctors because that's the culture and psychology that I know best. But the more I work with nurses and advanced practice providers who are immersed in medical culture and who also do get burned out and who get sued, by the way, the more I understand that we are all conditioned in fairly the same way and swim in the same sea and drink the same water in medicine. But I'm going to be talking about the way doctors are trained because that is what I know. And it's also so extreme in terms of time and intensity of indoctrination into our culture. So let us begin. Recently, there have been two circumstances I've been in more often that have made me really start to try to parse out this question of why doctors don't actively seek out mental health help or take people up on it when it's offered to them. And certainly, I had my own perspective about why I did not do those things when I was in the throes of litigation in the first few years. So those circumstances are, one, that I get a call from an institution that has set up a peer support program of some sort, and bravo to you, but no one's coming. No one's using it. And that's a topic that we're going to tackle on another day. But the other reason is that as I get more referrals from insurance companies or attorneys for the coaching work that I do, the more I'm encountering physicians who are not in a self-selecting group of people who have sought out coaching. So in other words, when I was first starting my practice, the people who came to me were looking for help. And that was, you know, kind of an easier group to work with. The thing that I have to overcome with those physicians is their skepticism. And I always tell them I can work with a skeptic, but I can't work with a wall. So if you come and you're like, I don't want to be here, then we're probably not going to get too far, or at least not until we start addressing the reasons behind the resistance. So I've been thinking about it a lot, and I tried to distill it into this listicast for you. And I think listicles are supposed to be short, but my listicast is not. Each of these topics is something that we could probably talk about at great length, and perhaps someday we will. But as always, if you really try to understand a complex topic, it is usually more nuanced and intertwined than you think it would be at first glance. So here is the list. I'm going to read it quickly, and then I'm going to go back and we're going to talk about each one just a little bit. Okay, so here's the list.
Reason number one.
Internal core beliefs and identity of the physician.
Reason number two.
External collective beliefs in medicine.
Reason number three.
Inability to recognize that help is indicated or, tangentially related, avoidance coping.
Reason number four.
Unawareness about methods that exist, or also invalidation of those methods.
Reason number five.
Family of origin or culture of origin taboos or expectations.
Reason number six.
Absent help infrastructure or a hush-hush help infrastructure.
Reason number seven.
Terminal uniqueness.
Reason number eight.
Fear.
Reason number nine.
Friction.
Reason number 10.
Change resistance and inflexible thinking. All right, that is the top 10 list. There might be other reasons, obviously, and every physician is an individual, but let us go back and look at each of these. Oh, and before we get into that, I think we probably should have defined what we mean by, quote, getting help, right? Usually when we say get help, we do mean it to be for someone who is in great emotional or mental distress. I don't love that phrase. I think it's judgmental, but that's basically our current vernacular when we talk about getting any kind of mental health optimization or assistance. And so when I say physicians are help resisting, yes, they're probably resisting therapy, and we're talking mostly about the physician who's clearly in distress. But the truth of it is that many physicians are resistant to the whole notion of mindset work or thought work or emotional regulation or really any of it. And so part of the question in this, and I think that this applies to the whole spectrum of what we mean by quote unquote help, is this question of why are we collectively so naive and maybe so arrogant as to believe as a whole in medicine that attending to or learning about and influencing our own habits of thought is something that we should look down upon. It's very interesting. And I was completely of that frame of mind, but let's think about that as we go through the reasons again in a little more detail.
Reason number one.
Internal core beliefs and physician identity. So this could be a whole hour by itself, but basically how we've been trained to think of who we are as doctors and who we had as role models and the identity that we've sort of assumed for ourselves now that we have become a physician. And the identity of a physician does not include someone who needs to work on their mind. It's like a weird version of the arrival fallacy. Like when you finally arrive at being a doctor, there's some magical transformation where now you know how to think and you never have to think about your thinking again. So if articulated, some of these beliefs would sound like doctors don't need help, or this is who I am, or doctors should be able to DIY their way out of mental health distress. We may never say things like that actually out loud, but those sentiments are probably in there somewhere. As I said in the last podcast of season one, to some degree, exceptionalism has helped us. It has helped us to achieve things that are truly remarkable. But if we look at a belief in our exceptionalism as a tool, it's a tool that we probably should learn how to put down sometimes. If we are inflexible in our exceptionalism, if we do truly believe that we have been trained to be exempt from basic human physical and emotional needs, and we just know how to take it, and that we should continue to do that all the time, that is going to eventually harm us. Similarly, perfectionism. A lot of us used perfectionism as a way to push ourselves to achieve greater things. The flip side of perfectionism is self-judgment and shame. And typically perfectionists will judge themselves very, very harshly and be very concerned about the judgment of others. And so if we're able to observe it and see it for what it actually is, we can see that in some ways it actually puts a ceiling on our achievements. It keeps us from looking for creative solutions to problems. It keeps us from trying new things. And it keeps us from accepting that sometimes external instruction or help is just that thing that you need to get over a hump so that you can keep going. But if you have an internal voice that tells you that you're a loser because you might want to get help with your thinking, or if you truly believe that you should, as a good doctor, you should not need this, then you are probably not going to accept it.
Reason number two.
Number two is external, collective, cultural beliefs of medicine. Of course, tied very closely to reason number one, because training in medical culture is how we assumed that identity. But an important thing to note is that medicine, like other cultures, uses shame as a tool of control. And in any society, shame helps to regulate the behavior of individuals and groups, but especially in medicine. And in medicine, there is this added threat of shame in larger society, like public shaming. And if somehow you're deemed to be a bad doctor, that's a terrible, terrible thing. And we've talked about that a lot when we've been talking about litigation. And because of some of the traits that I talked about in point number one, physicians in general are a very shame susceptible group. Lots and lots of perfectionists, and perfectionists don't deal with shame well. So shame shapes us and keeps us following the norms. And we spend so many years really just living medicine to the exclusion of everything else that those norms become very, very well known to us, whether they are explicit or implicit. And the norm is that role models, leaders, exceptional doctors don't really talk about mental health work or use peer support programs or access mental health help or work on their thoughts or beliefs or do self-help or really none of those things. None of those things are deliberately taught or modeled as hallmarks of an exceptional physician. And if we don't teach or model it in medicine, we kind of relegate it to a list of things that are either unimportant or self-indulgent or for the remedial or even shameful. And those aren't our norms. So we still have this archaic sort of framing of help as something that is suggested only for the weak and damaged, as in, it's okay if you need help, as opposed to learning these skills and having external support is smart for you and your career and your patients.
Reason number three.
This is an inability to recognize that help is indicated, or tangentially related, avoidance coping. So I probably should have divided these two up, but then I would have had 11 things in the list. So I think a lot of doctors are incapable of recognizing that they do indeed need help. It's sort of a foreign concept to them, and they don't see or haven't noticed that it's in their best interest to course correct in some way. And you might say, gosh, how could they not notice that they're miserable? I'll tell you, I was miserable for a lot of years, and it never occurred to me. It just wasn't on the menu in my own head. It wasn't even as though no one suggested it to me, first of all, but it just wasn't accessible to me as an idea. It just did not occur to me that that was something that I should do. Now, granted, that was a long time ago. That was 2007 through 15, basically. And things have changed a lot in the last decade, or at least they are slowly starting to change in greater society and less so in medicine. But there was a part of me that definitely felt like I was supposed to be miserable. I don't know if I would have articulated it that way, but I kind of had this belief that that was how it was supposed to be now. Now, the doctor who's using avoidance coping, and I don't mean to suggest that this is an overt strategy, like they're usually unaware that that is what they're doing, but this is a situation where even though there is some awareness that there is a problem that needs to be dealt with, dealing with that seems quite difficult and stressful, and so let's do something else. Let us avoid that problem, and perhaps we'll overwork. Perhaps we'll just get completely immersed in work, or take on new projects, or do a house renovation, or anything. Perhaps you'll do buffering activities like binging TV shows or overeating or overdrinking or really anything to avoid dealing with this head on, because that seems in and of itself quite difficult and stressful.
Reason number four.
Reason number four is a lack of awareness about methods of help that do exist. When you say get help, what does that even mean? What are the possibilities? What is the help? Physicians in general have a pretty poor understanding of options open to them, and that one option might appeal to them more than another. So if you learn about what all these initials are, CBT, ACT, DBT, EMDR, who knows? There's a lot of things out there that you might just not know about. Coaching might help. Self-help books might help. You really don't have any idea until you learn about them. And the weird corollary to this is that as doctors, we often feel like if we don't know about something, it's probably not that important or it doesn't work. And also, when I say that out loud, it really sounds ridiculous, but we do have this weird tendency to feel like that. We feel like we know about all the things, or at least all the important things that work. So it's pretty easy for us to sort of hand wave and be like, eh, you know, those things, they're not going to help me, when you don't really know anything about it. And we might trust other doctors who told us about those things, but there aren't any other doctors telling us about it.
Reason number five.
This one might be true for a lot of people, and it has to do with family of origin or culture of origin, taboos about any sort of psychological help, or expectations that are placed on the high achiever in the family. So think about Luisa in that movie Encanto. If you've always been the rock, it's hard not to always be the rock. And to admit that you need help being the rock brings you shame, might bring your parents shame, might bring your family shame, and that can be really difficult for some people.
Reason number six.
Reason number six is about help infrastructure. And by that, I mean talking about institutions. What do you have to offer your clinicians in terms of help? Are you offering anything? Are you even talking about this out loud? And if you do offer something, let's say you have a peer support program, how secret is it? Is it something that everybody would know about? Is it something that everyone could name somebody who utilizes it? Is it something that is a normal thing? Speaking of norms, is it a normal thing for people to use it? Because if it's not, and that's not your culture around it at your institution, they will probably be poorly utilized.
Reason number seven.
Reason number seven is terminal uniqueness. Now, what do I mean by that? So this is a concept that's most often talked about in the context of substance use disorders, but in doctors, it really seems to have something to do with that exceptionalism that I talked about in point number one. And the basic definition is that it is the false belief that the situation the person is facing is really not like things that other people face. And so techniques that might help other people will not be able to help them. In doctors, this could also manifest as a feeling like, I might need help, but there is no one who is not a doctor in this situation who understands what it's like to be a doctor in this situation. And if I tried to explain it to anybody who didn't really understand the situation, it would just take too long and be too hard. It wouldn't work.
Reason number eight.
Reason number eight is fear. And sadly, sometimes that fear is justified. In litigation, physicians are often worried about discoverability. And because of intrusive questions from state licensing boards or hospital privileges committees asking about whether someone has ever had treatment for their mental health, physicians are often very reluctant to get professional help or take prescribed medications because they might have to disclose those things. The Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation has been doing great things to change that, and you can check their work out at drlornabreen.org, and I'll drop a link in the show notes. But we are still pretty nervous about the discoverability of those interactions, or afraid that our peers will find out and judge us, or that somehow accessing this help will come back to haunt us professionally. But even in states where this is fairly protected, this belief remains pervasive. In litigation, if a physician is afraid, and they are told explicitly by their attorney not to talk to anyone, and there seems to be implicit messaging from medicine that they ought not to need to talk to anyone, well, they probably won't talk to anyone.
Reason number nine.
Reason number nine is friction. And by friction, I mean anything that makes getting help or accessing resources more difficult. And if you've got reasons 1 through 8 working against you, it does not take a lot of friction to keep you from following through on even a tiny inclination to start exploring new ideas or trying out a new modality to help your mental health. And the biggest source of friction against getting help among doctors is a lack of time. Like, who could possibly make the time for therapy or coaching or, gosh, even a self-help book or podcast? That time is usually getting sucked up by medicine. Or it could be that you don't want to take away from family time, or it could be that therapists also don't like working past 5 or 6 o'clock or on weekends, and you don't want to cancel patients or lose income. And it says a lot about the state of medicine right now that this is also a norm. You know, you're on a treadmill and you cannot get off. And getting help just seems like one more thing on a to-do list that never, ever, ever, ever ends. And the harder the climb to finding that help, like, you might not know where to start, you'll have to look things up, you don't want to ask anyone for recommendations because then they'll know, you'll have to make phone calls. I mean, I know it sounds silly, but that's all friction. If someone could magically clear your schedule for an hour and drop you in a session with someone that you immediately hit it off with, and of course paid for it too, then like, you'd probably think about it. But otherwise, who has the time?
Reason number 10.
Reason number 10 is change resistance and inflexible thinking. I will be talking about this again, but one point under this umbrella that I want to talk about today is this idea that the only reason that you are in distress is because of your circumstances, because of external factors over which you have no control. So there is no point in you changing anything about yourself, and there is no point in learning about these tools because they won't change the situation. For instance, you're being sued and it's a horrible situation. You made a mistake and it's a horrible situation. The way medicine works today is really, really challenging, and you're just out there trying to do good in a system that seems determined to keep you from getting things right. And you can't change that situation, or you feel like you can't change the situation. So what good is it to do anything to help improve my mental state when my mental state is not the problem? And all of those things are true. All of those things that I talked about are unfair. And at the same time, I believe that this is the time when having the ability to observe and influence your mind is the most crucial. Because when you're highly reactive and emotional, you cannot look for good solutions. Now, you don't have to stay in a job that is tearing you apart at the seams, and one day we'll talk about how to think about that decision. But unfortunately, once you're in litigation, you're in it. And I used to think that it was just an automatic, okay, I'll be miserable now until it's done. And probably even after that, this is the end. This is just the end of happiness and joy and lightheartedness. And that is what I accepted. This defeatist, oversimplified thinking that just led to a surrender to misery. It felt permanent. It felt true. It made sense. And it was wrong. And when I finally did get help, I started to learn that I had a lot more control over things than I thought I did. So there is my list. And the interesting thing about this list is that there's really not one thing on it that is not something we can't address as a group or as individuals. And particularly, I do mean addressing it on a larger level, not leaving it to the doctor to have to climb Everest to get help. I mean, making it easier to obtain help and new cognitive skills and mental health maintenance and growth, and making that a norm in medicine to encourage it by everybody learning about it and leaning into it and teaching it and working together to make changes that reduce that friction, to stand with organizations that are working to reduce the reasons for fear. And yeah, we can work on our own thinking as soon as we recognize our own resistance and learn to push back a little bit against it. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next month where we're going to start a conversation about board investigations. And if you happen to be listening to this the month that I'm releasing it, which is April 2024, I will be in Austin giving the keynote address at the AAEM, American Academy of Emergency Medicine, Scientific Assembly in Austin. I hope to see you there. If you're there, please come say hi, and we'll talk about help resistance. No.